I talked with Ray earlier in the week, and after we first met, and I was so, I just really kind of fell in love with his kind of music, and I said, gee, can you sing us or lead us or do something with a community-oriented song? So, take it away.
Well, I think one of the differences about music and community, out of community, at least, is that in community we sing together. So that's just a way of saying we're all going to sing this song. Okay. This is a song by Kathy Winter, who lives in Boston, Massachusetts. I thought it would be appropriate for this morning, since one thing that I realize, at least in my life, is that the root of building community is making friendships, being willing to see other people as friends, rather than just more numbers in the church or whatever. And this one is called Longtime Friends. And the chorus is very simple. It goes, I'm looking for some longtime friends. I'm looking for some longtime friends. Life's a long and twisted road, many curves and unseen bends. So I'm looking for some longtime friends. It goes like this. I'm looking for some longtime friends. I'm looking for some long-time friends. Life's a long and a twisted road, many curves and unseen bends. So I'm looking for some long-time friends. Can you get into that? Why don't you give it a try? I'm looking for some long-time friends. I'm looking for some long-time friends. So I'm looking for some long-time friends. Well, good friends tend to slip out of your reach. If you walk too tall and you keep too straight a path, with your eyes so far ahead that you can't see by your side, you'll never see your long-time friends. I'm looking for some long-time friends. I'm looking for some long-time friends. Life's a long and a twisted road, many curves and unseen bends. So I'm looking for some long-time friends. There are men I've held close to my heart, and women too will always be a part of my life. You've got to know each heart is real, and each life will touch your own.
Yeah, when you think about it, that whole notion of longtime friends for most of us is a key to whatever idea of community that we carry in our heads. And we're going to come back to that kind of a notion as we explore the set of ideas. What I'd like to do is to present some ways of thinking about the idea of community. All of us like to talk about politics, religion, and sex. Whether we know anything or not, we love to talk about that stuff. And the idea of community is central to all of those things. The way we deal with our religion and our politics and our sexuality very much wraps around our understanding of how it is that we are a people together. And so what I would like to do is give you, if you will, some kind of conceptual tools. How is it that you think about the idea of community? And just to begin with, the word itself comes out of a combination of two Latin roots. The Latin root communis for the common, and the Latin root the Latin word communitas for fellowship. And it's out of that that we have developed in English the word community. Fellowship itself is a very interesting notion. If you go back and look at the history of the word, I won't get into fellowship, but if you look at the history of the word, it has to do with people trusting each other with their cows. And it really is worth looking at. If we have time, I'll tell you about that. But anyway, part of what we are doing in community or fellowship is, among other things, trusting each other with our cows. Now, community has been talked about in an immense variety of ways. In the mid-1950s, a sociologist named George Hillary did an examination of the sociological literature and found 94 different definitions of community in the social science literature, and the only thing that they had in common was that they all were about people. And even that's not always true. When I first went to work at the university I served, I went immediately to the library to see what books they had on community, since that's one of my fields of interest. And the first book said Community by an author I didn't know, and I went into the stacks and found it, and it was about biological ecosystems. And communities that animals build within niches and ecosystems. So the word is on the verge of being a wastebasket word. That is, there are so many definitions that we have to be rather careful when we talk about it, because people use it in so many different ways. So hopefully what I'm doing today is going to, fill in some pieces or give you some working definitions and understandings of the idea of community. Now, I'd like to begin by suggesting that we see that all of us operate within a range of human associations. There are ways in which we associate with each other. And I have a kind of a list of levels. First of all, there is a level of intimacy or communion, and that is generally what you would find in family relationships, all right? Then below that is what I call community. I'm going to come back to that. But I mean by community that social network in which you find individual significance and group solidarity. Now I'll come back and fill that in. Then beyond the level of community, there are voluntary associations. That is where we gather together around some kind of specific cause, course, idea, agenda, or whatever. There are then functional relationships for our associations. For example, when you call the gas company, a human being answers the phone. Now, in reality, you are engaging directly with the human being, but you really don't care what their name is, what their family's like, or anything like that. You are engaged in a functional relationship. You are relating very seriously, but it's strictly in terms of the function. And then finally, there's a way in which all of us participate in some kind of very, very large scale forms of association, the largest being the state. And we have kind of pieces. We all act as pieces in the state. It's kind of the largest association that we have. Okay, now within that range, what I would like to identify for you is this level between intimacy and voluntary association as a level of community. Now, it gets really tricky because in theological literature, in sociological literature, in political literature, you all the time find people using the word community at all these other levels. The only way we're going to make it as a world is if we are a community together, right? All 5 billion. See the last week sometime, the 5 billionth person was born? See that in the paper? They celebrated it in Zagreb, Yugoslavia, or someplace like that. The head of the UN went and gave this little baby a plaque as the 5 millionth person. I don't know. Who knows? But anyways, we talk about the world community. Well, that has some meaning, but that gets really, that's really tricky. We talk about the urban community. We talk about the community in all kinds of ways. I would like us to consider community between the level of intimacy and the level of voluntary association. Why? Let me get into that. Let me suggest a definition that says, what are the marks of community? The marks of community is that group of human beings where there is a reciprocal thing of individual significance and group solidarity. I feel a part of that group. I have significance in this group. If I were not there, somehow the group would be different. And that is matched by a sense of group solidarity. There is a thing which we have together. The group has a sense of its groupness. Okay? And what I experience and what the group together experiences are a set of shared symbols shared values, and shared activities. Okay, look at what we have been through this week together. Even those of us who have only been here a few days, we are actively participating in a community. And we can very clearly identify shared symbols, shared values, and shared activities. You know, and it is absolutely no accident that Holden Village insists that we are all together in worship every night. Now, from my perspective, right now I've got my sociology hat on. I'm not talking as a theologian, but as a sociologist. From my perspective, it doesn't really matter whether worship is good or not. What matters is that it is a shared activity. And that from a community building perspective, even though over the last couple weeks, you know, there have been some worship things that you like and some that you haven't and so on, the fact that everybody is together in worship, the fact that everybody is together at meals, is a very important community building thing because it is done in common. And there, of course, there are various symbols and other kinds of values. Consider the varieties of places that we go in terms of conferences or other kinds of meetings. Very rarely do we run into the value that we find here of people always making sure that they have introduced themselves to each other. You all experience that? You sit down at the table, you walk into, people are forever saying, well, what was your name again, and so on. There is an ethos, there is a value that is placed upon that shared activity. Okay? Now, I would like to suggest that any place where you think something called community is going on, you then can look for these marks. Is there a way in which an individual sees their own significance? Is there a way in which there is group solidarity evident through shared symbols, shared values, and shared activities? If you did an analysis of the groups that you belong to, all of us probably, given the kind of involved tilt that all of the people around here seem to have, all of us probably belong to, when you sit down, think about 10, 12, 15, 20, 25 different kinds of groups, forms of human association. If you did an analysis of the groups that you belong to, there are liable to be one or two that just, aha, that's the group where there really is some solidarity and some shared symbols, values, and so on. What we know in community is one another in wholeness. And in knowing one another in wholeness, there is that sense of we-ness. There is a we, which of course, interestingly enough, means that there's a them someplace, which is... In what's called conflict theory, one of the essential, if you have a conflict theorist, they'll say that the only way to build community is to build enemies or adversaries. That in fact, the strongest community building activity is to find a common enemy. You know, that's a whole other, we won't get into that one. In urban history, there is an interesting discussion of what are known in communities as primary, secondary, and tertiary sorts of relationships. Primary relationships are those that you know in wholeness, secondary in terms of partial wholeness and function, and thirdly, completely in terms of function. The image is given in medieval towns. The baker and the cobbler live down the street from each other, and not only do they know each other in terms of what they do, but they know each other's families and friends. They have known each other's grandparents. They all go to the same church together. They all defend the city together, and so on. And as urban society has gotten more and more complex, we have pulled away from knowing each other in wholeness. And so we end up with the example of the gas company person, that we know each other simply in functional sorts of ways. So a mark of community is that we are known in wholeness, that we know each other's brokenness, that we know each other's families, something about each other's lives, and also that in knowing each other in wholeness, there's a kind of we-ness. So a way of defining community might be to talk about a community is a known social network, a social network where you know the elements within it. The elements within it are individually significant to you, and the elements within it gather in some sense of solidarity with shared symbols and all. You with me?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, that's very different from other ways of talking about community. There is a split, there's a discussion going on within sociological literature between the people who are basically on this side of the avenue that say that community is a function of a social network that has psychocultural kinds of bonds that keep that network together, and a more traditional sociological understanding that says the community is defined by geography. And many of you have probably run into that. You know, what is community? Community is a place. Community is a territory, the social organization within that territory, and the bonds and symbols that tie that organization to that territory. And much of sociological literature has to do with that kind of understanding of community. Now, most of us fall into that because if somebody says, what's your community? Part of the time, depending on the context, part of the time you're going to say, well, my community is a suburb outside Chicago. My community is a town in Minnesota. My community, you know, we think, well, my community, that's where I live. That's my territory. Okay? But if somebody says, where do you feel a sense of community, you're going to give a whole different definition. Well, I feel community in my coffee klatch, in my church, in my political activity. You know, I feel a sense of wholeness there. So you probably yourselves experience that kind of split between community as a place where we are and community as a sense of wholeness. Okay, now, how has some of this come about? What are our roots? How have these things crept inside our heads? And I'd like to suggest about three or four kind of historical concepts that have led to the idea of community and why we talk to each other this way. First of all, of course, you know, where do you start? You start in Athens and Jerusalem. You know, everything starts in Athens and Jerusalem. Well, if we go back to Athens, we have the polis. The polis is Greek for people or population or politics, which or the state or the city, you know, metropolitan. Politician? Okay. If you ever want to explore this, there's a very interesting distinction between the way Plato came at this business and the way Aristotle came at this business, and I won't get into that today. There's a wonderful book called The Social Philosophers by Robert Nesbitt that you could look at. But Aristotle is the person I want to talk about, first of all. For the Greeks, the polis was the city-state. And the polis was the political environment. That's what people lived inside of. It was the community. And Aristotle, when he was writing the Politics, his book The Politics, says, first four words, five words. Every state is a community. And then he goes on and on and on. What Aristotle was trying to get at was, we need to understand that the person is formed by the social environment that they are a part of. Okay? That the person is shaped by the polis. Now, Aristotle wrote a little bit later in the Politics, man is, and of course the Greeks only talked about men because the rest were women and slaves. And that's another whole issue. But Aristotle wrote, man is by nature a political animal. Now, how do we generally use that? We use that in a derogatory term. You know, somebody says, boy, they were nasty politicians. Then we say, well, you know, people are just, by nature, they're political. Okay? That's not what Aristotle meant. What Aristotle meant was human beings are by their nature a function of their community. You cannot understand human beings without understanding the community that they're a part of. That's what that means. Man is by nature a political animal. Human beings are in their nature shaped by their community. It's got nothing to do with political wheeling and dealing. That's what Jody's talking about. Human beings are by nature political. That is, we are by nature created social beings. We cannot define ourselves outside of the community we are a context of.
It's biblical too.
Hang on. In the Old Testament, we have, and you all know this very well, your point exactly, that we exist in covenant, that there is in fact a combination of the land, the promise, and the people that are all in covenant with God, and that the notion is that once we were no people, now we are people. Once we had no meaning, but it's in our coming together, and you're precisely right. That Old Testament understanding is that it's our meaning comes out of our community with God. Okay? So that the Old Testament would say that the only way to understand my individual significance as a person is in terms of the way that we are a group in solidarity with God. The only way my individual significance makes sense is when I understand it in terms of our existence as a gathered community, a political, social, communal reality. Okay, now, in the New Testament, similar thing happens, but the New Testament does a very new kind of thing. The New Testament talks about the person in relation to community. And that I cannot be understood except as I am part of the gathered people of the Christian community. Paul, when he wrote his letters to the churches, had to invent over 70 new words in Greek to describe the communal nature of the church. And if you go in and you analyze the language of the New Testament, and this will ring with you, you know, all those words that say we are fellow heirs with one another, we are sufferers with Christ, heirs with each other. There are a whole series of something like 23 Greek with compounds that Paul invented that are no place else in the Greek language. You know, Paul had to create the with words and a set of family language to reflect the power of this kind of relationship. That the only way we can understand ourselves as faithful people is in terms of the community. That other set of compound words, fellow sufferers, fellow inheritors, can you think of some of those? Well, anyways, as you go through the letters, you will discover a whole set of the with compounds and the fellow compounds that are all new words that Paul had to create. Okay. The other thing that I want to point to is one of the ways that we talk about community today, which you may not know the source of, and that is the theology of Martin Buber. And Martin Buber talked about I and thou. And the book that he wrote, I and Thou, was written in 1925. And it's fairly interesting to read, and when you read the book, it reads a lot. It has a lot of that stuff, kind of the relational language that a lot of us have used for the last 20 or 30 years. And an awful lot of that relational language comes out of Buber's writings in the 1920s. And Buber really tried to get at the fact that our self-understanding and definition is not a function of ourselves alone, but is a function of ourselves in relationship. That the key element is not person, 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 person. The key element in human life is relationship, 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 relationship. And that's the key. The book is not about you and me, or me and you. The book is about what it is that we have together. And whether you look at linguistic analysis or any number of other cultural things, what we create is stuff that we create together. We don't do things by ourselves. And again, I think that that is a crucial element in trying to understand the idea of community. The community is not a thing, you know, like I am here and then somehow I step into community, but rather the only way to understand myself is to see those groups that have shaped me and which I'm a part of.
Why then has the Jewish community failed in really being they created? Bettelmann writes about that, and they saw a lot of ideals in that way of life, but there are failures in there too, and I think creativity is one of them. Or don't you agree?
Well, I think that, I mean, I've read some of that, I've read some of that kind of literature, and I think that part of the tension that is really, you know, part of what's very interesting in the West, and of course, you know, we do the community thing different than other folks do, but there is that real tension between how much, when you exist in various kinds of human associations, you know, how much of what we do is formed by, you know, community levels of association or by other kinds of levels. And I think, you know, there are other examples, I think, like in early childhood also, where when so much stress is put on the group solidarity stuff and less on the individual significance stuff, there may be some kind of dwindling of creativity. I mean, you know, it would be interesting to analyze that tension.
Because I see it in the communist system that stresses community, and certainly from that book, Bettelmann.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very much for community, don't get me wrong, but yeah, there are the shady sides of it.
That's right. And I guess part of what I would say from this kind of a frame would be maybe the interesting thing is to say that you could critique the kibbutz or perhaps some kind of communist process in asking yourself, where is the balance between the two sides of this kind of interlocking thing? You know, the individual significance versus the group solidarity. You know, it seems to me that both have to be there, but we may all move through systems where that shifts around.
Well,
okay, what do you think? Yeah, go ahead.
If we did not have the variety from the outside that comes in to share, it would become very staid and stale, and then would gradually fall apart.
Right, right.
So we share some things, but we bring in more.
Yeah, and you know, when you think about it, it's very interesting how Holden does go to some lengths to identify individuals. You know, that introduction of everybody, and also the kind of very, very interesting. It's not really a hierarchical system, but it slices this way. There are kind of people that are here visiting, recreating, or whatever. There are people who are here as volunteer staff. There are people who are here as teaching staff. I mean, people are known in a variety of roles. They are seen in different kinds of ways, and there are the continually new individual inputs that balance all these kind of shared activities. And that might be an interesting way to, you know, if the community is running down, maybe the problem is because the solidarity is too strong. Oftentimes communities appear to run down because the individual activity is too strong.
Isn't that also a survival thing, really what it is? In the making of America, I'm sure the communities had to come to survive.
Yes, yeah. Come back tomorrow, and I'm going to talk about the American experience of community, because we've had a really rich array from the covenanted kind of community to various forms of utopian and exclusivistic kinds of communities. So that's a want to explore that some.
I don't, then that maybe that's why I should bring it up. I think it was some of it.
Go ahead.
Is the relationships, for instance, in cultic groups.
Uh-huh.
We're going to deal with that tomorrow. I don't know. But some of the experience you've seen with in Seattle, we've got the Love family, and in Oregon, the Rajneesh, and you have other cult groups that are formed in which the individual significance is lost. In other words, only joined because you can lose that, and it's a there's kind of the paradox of it, that a group of people assume all the responsibility and all of the power.
Yeah.
And the individual is lost in that kind of situation. I think that's why they fail.
And you see, I would say, I think, one, that's why they fail, but number two, I think that's it would be important to, or at least I would urge you to not think of them as communities, because a mark of a community is that individuals are known in their wholeness and they have their own significance. And right, that's the mark of a community, that it has the shared solidarity, but it also has the way in which they are known. Now, it's real interesting. Think about your churches. Are your churches communities? Or are your churches voluntary associations? That is, gathered together for a variety of good purposes, but that may have some shared activities and so on. But is it a place where we are somehow known, or somehow know that we are fully a piece of that? I would suggest that there may be a good number of our congregations.
Well, it depends on the size. We are 140 units. I think we are considered a family. I certainly feel it as a community. But I wonder if I would, in a membership of 4,000.
Yeah, right.
I have no experience in those things.
And maybe what you have to do in large-scale church, in very large scale, that you've got to say that, you know, our church is a voluntary association. We are gathered as, you know, the 4,000 Lutherans or the 4,000 whatevers in this area. But we very deliberately within our church create a series of communities.
It certainly happens between services, there's no question. And in our some of our Lutheran practices, you have the first service and the second service.
And
you see, you determine how voluntary your association is going to be, which gets you into how big, how much you are part of the group.
Yeah.
And that's individual.
Yeah. And you know, sometimes people really get down on that, having two different groups, two different services. But in these kind of terms, that might be very important, because people might be able to get a sense of being known and being a part of and sharing some common life with this group, whereas if both groups were together, you would lose that. Now, I'm not sure that you can have a community of over, well, I'm always reluctant to put numbers on it, but I think if you push 400 or 500 people, I don't think it's possible to be in community above that, simply because as elaborate as our computers are, we really can't know more people than that, which, you know, raises interesting questions. Yeah?
I had a question about, you know, when you were talking about the cults and how they aren't community, but I know people who have been in them who say one reason why they didn't leave was because of the community, you know, that they had built up and they felt a part of it. And that was one thing that pulled them to stay. They hated to leave that community. So what is that then if it's not a community?
Well, but see, I would, you know, I mean, I think that's really, there are thousands of examples throughout American history of the formation of communities that have really provided this kind of thing, a place of real deep belongingness, of knownness for individuals, and a real sense of solidarity. And that lots of people, the literature is immense in terms of people talking about these kinds of experiences. The thing that I was pointing to was the fact that it seems to me that one of the directions that the cult phenomenon goes that leads to their breaking up is when, in fact, that sense of belongingness, if you will, becomes a sense of entrapment. Or the people, all, you know, there are cults that, that very successfully keep that together. There are other intense communities that move to a point where the people lose that sense. And then that's, you know, that's where it breaks up. But yeah, I think, you know, when people say to us, like, you know, you have a friend that goes to a, you know, perhaps a church experience that is very, very different from yours. And you say, well, why in the world did you go to that? I mean, they're a bunch of strange people. And they say, but I felt I was addressed there. You know, I was welcomed there. I was a part of it. That's a very powerful message that, you know, it's important to hear. That somehow or another, their life, their personhood was addressed by this group.
Another term of literature is pseudo-community. In other words, it is not a community. It's a pseudo. It appears, represents.
Yeah. I mean, I would, you know, I think there are things that
because
look a lot
not
like
a community. They look like it, but they're not.
Yeah.
But your individual significance gets in there too. Some people don't want to. They feel comfortable knowing the wholeness of just these people, and they don't want it anymore. And so they'll stay there where they don't have to explain it anymore.
We know firsthand from East Germany how that system worked. I was just absolutely appalled about it. When we first went in there, how they wanted to bring everybody to one level, the sharing of brotherhood, or whatever it's called, you know, wealth as well. Academia was pressed down, labor people were put up, so everybody had more. This is going on, this went on 20 years ago in East Germany. And I cannot think of any more discrimination than that. And it's exactly the opposite of what they're trying to do. I find that very, very evil. Really.
Yeah,
and the intent were good, really, but I don't think that works. I think that's oppressing people, really, what it is.
You know, in the a lot of the communal experiments in the United States, one of the things that was hit upon independently by a number of independent communities has been what one of the things that in some communist environments has also been played with, and that's the mutual criticism circles. And if you think about it, that is related to what we talk about with confession. That part of the way that we are able to deal with the overwhelmingness of the community, if the community gets really strong, is that is a place where we bring our own individual lives, confessions, strengths, or whatever. In some non-Christian environments, they have done a similar thing with mutual criticism, where it becomes a place where the individualism is revealed. But I think that's always that struggle, and I think what you're pointing to with Western Europe, Eastern Europe, as I understand what's going on in Eastern Europe right now, is that they are re-examining the whole understanding of how is it that individuals are known. You know, in China, I understand, one of the things that's going on is that people are starting to wear different kinds of clothes, you know, because there is something about how do I express, how am I known through my dress or my behavior or whatever. So that, you know, how does that tension work so that, you know, both pieces are there?
How does it work in the church?
Well, how do you think it works in the church?
Well, in a way, you know, I'm thinking about how people express their individual significance, and you know, the first thing that comes to mind is you have to do something that involves work, you know, serve on some kind of board, committee, commission, or
something. Sing in the choir.
I would always say, I think we all have different gifts, and know who you are, and I think use what you have, you do the best at that.
One of the things that always struck, I can remember very clearly when I was a kid, I was always impressed by all these folks that donated all of their energy, or all this energy to the church, you know, that you know, serving in the choir, doing these other kind of things. And one of the things I've discovered as I've gotten older is that large numbers of people are doing that because that's what they like to do. And I thought, wow. maybe part of what we have to be really sensitive to in the church is, as we are coming to know one another, is to find the things that turn people on and make sure that if there is not that going on in our community right now, that we create that. So that the context I'm in now, I'm regularly surprised by people who are absolutely willing to do all kinds of things because we are asking them to do what they love to do. And that's a wholly different thing than the, you know, if the only way that I can have significance in the community is if I chair a committee, that may be very frightening. But if I know that in this community I can have significance by using my X talent, you know, that then becomes, you know, a building kind of thing.
What would that be, though? I mean, what are you thinking?
Well, I guess I'm saying, you know, how do you develop mechanisms so that we are knowing each other well enough so that we know then the ways in which we can call upon people's strengths or their skills or whatever it is. And there may be lots of ways to do that.
Doesn't your too large a community automatically sort of break down into smaller communities of people that feel more comfortable in this spot as part of a whole big community?
Well, I think so. But then my model would suggest that as the church grows as an institution, you build smaller communities within that. Mm-hmm. You have to be very deliberate and conscious of the need for both sides of that tension. The you know, how many churches have, if you will, lots of folks involved in Christian education, and yet there never is a time when all of those folks get together. Okay.
We have three Sunday schools.
Yeah, and what you have to very deliberately do is to build that community, the Christian education community. What you've got to do is make sure that every year you've got a couple dinners where they all get together and you have a special worship service where they're all presented. So there become some very specific shared symbols and values where they know that this Sunday school teacher that's teaching every Sunday is important because I'm a part of a larger thing. There is, a communal sense that grows around that, even though the church itself may have, you know, thousands of members.
Our church has worked real hard at doing that. And I think it's partially successful. When you get large groups of people together, you can't always get them to come to everything. But the, like Sunday school, there are 90-some teachers. And they have meetings. She tries to do two, fall, winter, spring, you know, two each time. And has pie and coffee and has something for that. They have a retreat that is just given to the teachers. You don't pay to go to that at our retreat center. And then they have an appreciation brunch. And they do that for every single small group kind of thing in our church, because anything in our church that's small group is about that size. You know, it's not a real small group. And I think they really made a big effort. But that still only gets some of the people. I mean, that's not by far the majority of that congregation.
Yeah, but then the question is, how then do you find ways to create kind of conscious community for, you know, for other groups? And I would maintain that to create that conscious community, it has to be a way that it is saying, we recognize who you are in terms of X. And somehow that X fits with other stuff so that there's a sense of solidarity.
Doesn't it take a wonderful, trusting environment, intimacy, honesty, in order that people come forth and say, this is what I can do, or that we can recognize in another person these gifts, supports them, enables them to do more. This, I think, critical. That's not always easy to do. Am I right on that?
Well, yes. Yeah.
How do we recognize the gifts in people? Not everybody is upfront, you know, say, I can do this.
We have a written questionnaire every once in a while.
Yeah, we do.
But some people would rather not even get involved in that much of it.
And the whole thing is not quite the same than a touch, personal, warm, one-to-one approach, knowing your people in your community.
My sense in what you're saying is that community is a thing that keeps on building, and that I've been very impressed this week at Holden by the number of contexts in which people have talked about the notion of hospitality or welcoming in. And I have there is a real question in my mind of how successful we are as congregations in really, you know, bringing people in. You know, and really saying to them, you know, we really want you to be a part of us. And I think we a lot of us operate out of the assumption that we have, you know, we have a shared set of something or other. And if you want to come in, well, you can come in if you want to. But we don't do that kind of act of welcoming. And that might be a part of how it is that we find the individual significance. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
What role would you say that worship has in the creation of and expression of community?
Well, I think that in talking about shared symbols, values, and activities, the notion of worship really becomes the representative element. And that for churches, worship is the, in my mind says, that worship is the key event for churches. And that if we do not, as I said at the very beginning, it is absolutely no accident that the one thing that people do at Holden is that they worship together. And there are a number of folks in the church that see worship as one of several activities that we do. I would say, now kind of shifting theologically, that for those of us inside the church, worship is the central event, because that is the place where we most clearly share our symbols, our values, and our activities. And we just have to pay attention to that, and that has to be as powerful as it can possibly be, because of the interesting irony is that we are absolutely together in worship and we are absolutely alone. And if you think about this individual significance group solidarity, does a worship experience allow people to deal with their own thing? I mean, I'm always surprised at the number of churches, for example, that don't have silent prayer. Because I believe silent prayer is really important as that time when people can focus inside themselves and give over to God what it is they have to give. That is about the most intimate, personal thing that we can do. And that ought to be a part of worship, because you've got to have that way in which a person says, I am known through the sharing of my joys and concerns verbally. I am known through my personal prayer time. I am known through being touched physically by other people. And I am a part of a group solidarity because of the word, the prayers, the hymns, da 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 da. So worship is, I think, a central communal category for us. Yeah.
Well, as far as getting individuals involved, when acolyting first was accepted back, it was boys only. The girls were very upset. Well, pretty soon that was modified, and now any of your kids that are in their classes will be allowed. However, you always think of men as being the ushers, and the women run the Alder Guild. Well, we have several husband and wife teams in Alder Guild, so that on Maundy Thursday when the Alder is stripped, you will see men up there working just as well as women, and doing the cups and the whole business.
Yeah, if you set aside, a lot of times we talk about inclusive language as a way of understanding God. But if you set that whole argument aside and you talk about inclusive language and activity as a way for folks to discover their individual significance, you know, when my daughter is sitting in worship and she sees teenage boys and girls ushering, when she sees, you know, male and female pastors, when she sees, you know, male and female leadership throughout the life of the church, that becomes a way that her individual self is tied into it. And, you know, when you think about it at that level, it is, it's just really important that we're doing those kinds of things. And that's a rather different, that modeling for each other in community, both male and female modeling in the community, is a rather different kind of concern than the whole argument that we often get into about, well, how do we deal with God language? But that's, I think, is as important a part of the inclusive struggle. Because, you know, I think you're really, that's a piece of it. And that's, that becomes shared. And that's the kind of stuff that, you know, people in our congregations may never remember what the ministers say 20 years from now. But they're going to remember if Sunday after Sunday after Sunday, there was both male and female visibility in worship.
Speaking of modeling, I just like to share this. We have a group of handicapped, retarded children, and they have been more just in the last two, three years, been coming and being active part, and they broke the ice in our congregation by doing their own prayers, personal prayers, when this was opened up. And I really think it just did a lot to all of us. It was just, it broke the inhibitions, I think. And it helped us an awful lot. We were really a special gift.
So you mean now you have a community prayer time?
Yeah, people are more free to put it in words instead of just being silent.
And some during worship.
Ability to silent prayer, I'm not saying that.
But during worship?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I think that's exposure. I think you have to be in a setting where you see it, you can become comfortable and participate, and you take it. We have had numbers of people from our congregation come here. When the new Green Book came out, it had been here for a long time in essence. If, when it came time to start sharing the piece, and we had not had a group of people who had been to Holden and had done it for years, our congregation had said, "You're crazy. We're not going to do that. Yeah. That's terribly foreign. We're not going to." But where there had been enough of us that we sort of knocked the wall down before it finally got built.
We also carry each other's burden, and I think by open prayer, you find out what their problem is. I mean, how can you possibly know? I know some of my closer friends, they tell it to me, but I certainly don't know of everybody's problem. And I think that is wonderful. Then you know you can help if you know what it is. How do you find out otherwise?
Yeah, people sometimes don't want you to know that they've got these problems. There's pride in there.
Well, that's true.
Their problem is.
That's true. That's true. You know, I'd like to let me take this point, and given that it's, we've got about 1 minute or so, let me take that point and just pose a question at the end. I've suggested to you that in this kind of analysis of human associations, that the idea of community sits between the notion of intimacy, you know, for example, family life, people together in significant relationships, and voluntary associations. It seems to me that much of what we do in the church, in the churches, tends to be in this realm, where we have elements of community, individual significance and group solidarity, but we really move in the direction of voluntary associations. That is, we are gathered to do stuff. We are gathered around agendas or causes. Maybe part of the challenge for the churches as we keep moving into the future is to shift ourselves and to think about the churches as being communities, but moving in the direction of communion. And I think that what the comments you were making, the last comments we've made about worship and about prayer and about really coming to know each other, has to do with moving us in the realm of real communion, real intimacy. How is it that the church becomes the place where not only we have all of our shared symbols and stuff, we are known, but also we move to that point where, in fact, the water is as thick as the blood. That what we share as folk together, as faithful folk together, becomes as powerful and as deep and as connected as what we share within family life or other kinds of significant relations. And the notion of communion, it seems to me, moves us in that kind of direction. And that may be a very interesting critique of how it is that we busy ourselves in our associations. You know, we are incredibly busy as church folk, and that may not be getting us to God.
Do you think that's possible without putting more time in?
Yeah. Actually, I do. I think this the challenge I feel. Now, I was in higher education for 16 years. I've now been in a full-time pastorate for 7 months. And I think clearly the challenge for me is not how much time, but the allocation of time.
Quality time.
It's the direction of the time, the quality of the time, and that if, in fact, we make judgments that our community will move toward communion, that's just a different way of thinking about ourselves than the judgments we make where our community moves towards association. And that's I don't think it means more time, it means different time.
Does it take, you'd be willing to give up worship time to do that?
Well, I know, see, I see worship time as central.
Change the structure of the worship service.
I think we've got it. What I'm involved in right now with the congregation I serve is a very scary struggle for me of saying, how is it that I can create the conditions so that our gathering together as worship becomes communion rather than that moves in the direction of communion rather than the direction of association. And that may be the church struggle for our time. I mean, I think that, here I'm ending. I started as a sociologist, I'll end as a preacher. I think the society, our larger society, is moving in increasingly demonic directions. And I'm not talking about what's going on politically or that kind of stuff. I'm talking about what we, in fact, are doing to each other, what we are doing to our collective children, what we are doing to our uses of our resources and time. You know, the fundamental stuff, I think, is getting increasingly demonic, and we're not noticing it. And that our challenge for all of us who are in churches, not often places like Holden, but in churches, may make increasingly large distinctions between what it means to be the gathered community of faithful people and how that is really different in communion from the Boy Scouts and the Kiwanis and the political organizations and the activists and all that stuff. And I think that may be part of our challenge, moving in this direction, and that is that will begin in worship. The ways that we are, we really do belong to each other, and to take that seriously, to really, that is an incredibly scary thing.
Most people won't want to go that way.
That's right, but that's why,
lead them along.
That's why I say one of
very
the things you do
slowly,
but I think that's why worship is so important. That you say in worship and people sit there and, every once in a while somebody is in tears in worship because all of a sudden you've crossed some bound where you have all of a sudden touched deeply the source of whatever they are. And that's what we have to do.
You think of the rows of pews, they really don't lend themselves to community.
Well, yeah, that's another. Yeah. Amen to that. Thank you all very much.